This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening, you're tuned in to 2 Degrees Centigrade. I'm your host, Ezra Zaid. This is a show where we talk about how climate change is affecting us today, why our everyday choices matter, and what we can do to mitigate those consequences. Today, we're going to look toward one of the greenest capital cities in the world, Copenhagen. The Scandinavian city is well known for its emphasis on sustainability and its urban planning, as well as an overall culture among its people of leading a low carbon footprint lifestyle. And now, Copenhagen is working its way toward becoming the first carbon-neutral capital in the world by 2025. So I wondered if Malaysia could learn a thing or two from Copenhagen's green strategies. Here with me are two people who've lived in both lands and who've observed both environments for some time. They're His Excellency Mr. Nikolai Ruji, Danish Ambassador to Malaysia. Also joining us is Dr. Shireen Faris, Senior Lecturer in the Faculty of Design and Architecture at University Putra, Malaysia. She's also the author of a new book titled Cerita Laman Kehidupan dari Copenhagen, in which she wrote about her research on the city's culture and urban design. Thank you so much for coming in. And we're going to be talking a lot about Copenhagen and more specifically their respective green strategies to find out whether we could learn a thing or two about sustainable living as well. Maybe just to kick things off, and we have two different perspectives here, could you both maybe paint a picture for listeners who might not have been to Copenhagen? How would you describe the city and also, I guess, shed some light about how green the city is?
I would say that Copenhagen is characterized by being at the water. There's a lot of canals, but it's also actually facing, part of it is really facing more the ocean. So that determines very much the city. It's not a very hilly city, which has definitely also helped to give it that strong, the strong presence of bicycles everywhere. It's being promoted by the municipality, but it's also loved and in the DNA by the citizens. And it's not a very tall city. You wouldn't find a lot of buildings sort of above 10 stories. It's more sort of characterized, of course, by the medieval city center and then sort of the more modern, but still not particularly tall areas around it. Does that give a little bit of an impression of the city?
It's pretty good. Yeah. But of course, Dr. Shireen, you've spent some time studying the city. How would you describe it?
Well, when I was there in 2009, what really struck me was that in terms of the people, there's so many unwritten rules about Copenhagen. Yes. Mm. So I learned a lot the hard way. So, for instance, when we talk about being green, you mentioned about being green. So when I first arrived, we went to the supermarket to buy our food and all that. And then we're so used in Malaysia, like after we pay for it, people put in a plastic bag. And then suddenly, hey, what happened to my stuff? You just leave it there. Then I know you have to bring your own bag, you know. So, I mean, recently in Malaysia, we start to do that. And then, for instance, when we talk about to recycle items, when we bought like bottled drinks, I said it was stated something else, but when I paid, it was like 1 to 3 kroner more. And I said, what happened? Oh, when you want your money back, you have to recycle it. So it's really impressed me how people can be taught, or we can learn from there, not to force people to do it, but we know that we have to do it. So this is what I learned about when we talk about the people and their attitude.
Let's talk a little bit about the people of Copenhagen and, I guess, their attitudes towards green living. Has it always been the case, or has it been something that has to be sort of developed over a longer period of time?
It has developed over a longer period of time. If you see photos, black and white photos from 1950s and even 60s from Copenhagen, you'd see all the squares were full of cars. You know, they were parking lots. Very unattractive spaces in the city. But there was a deliberate decision taken to change that and, you know, bring those squares back into life as part of the city and reduce the number of cars.
And what was the tipping point?
I think there was a realization that the city center was being choked in traffic. And, you know, it was getting too polluted and there was too many cars. So we simply had to make a decision of changing the direction of the city. I guess we could have built underground tunnels or we could have built flyovers, or but instead we tried to reduce the traffic by moving more people into public transport and by expanding the bicycle network, making it much more attractive for people to choose the bicycle instead of the car. And now 50% of Copenhageners do.
And of course, you know, when we talk about the harbor, I mean, even in the 90s, it was still polluted then. And of course, right now, it's almost become, you know, a swimming spot for a lot of locals there as well. And that's such a drastic shift, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. When we were there, we were really surprised to see how clean the water is. And during summer, people were just jumping in and having fun. So I think this is something that Malaysia could have, you know, when we can work towards it. It's not impossible to have that when you turn it around into a recreational space.
Yeah. Dr. Shireen, you spent some time in Copenhagen to research the city's design and architecture. You wrote a book. And, of course, it basically details your findings. And the book is titled Cerita Laman Kehidupan dari Copenhagen. And I guess, going on about your initial reactions in observing the city, what inspired you to write this book?
All right. Actually, my background is in landscape architecture. But of course, I work very closely with the architects and the planners and the urban planners, you see. So when I was in Copenhagen and also some of the other cities in Denmark, I found out that there are so many new innovative designs in the buildings. But at the same time, they are also maintaining the old buildings and conserving it and turning it into something else. But what I can see that when I was there, I was surprised to see during working hours, people are using the parks. I was like, you know, like in Malaysia, from 8 to 5, people are in offices. What are these people doing? You know, are they not working? Then I found that one of the aspects is that when I saw mothers pushing prams during between 9 to 5, or instead during working hours in Malaysia, I found out that there's a long maternity leave and also paternity leave. So they believe that during the 1 year of the babies, when the baby were born, and then that's the most when they need the parents. So that's why the parks have been used during this time. I can see the mothers taking the children, and because they have, they were given the time to spend with the children. So this is where the green spaces are being used to the fullest. So I think that's very fantastic, the way I look at it. And another thing, I feel very safe, even with all the forest and all that. I think this is what I miss being in Malaysia when using the green spaces.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about, I guess, those working hours from 9 to 5. More than a third of Copenhageners cycle to work, to study around the city, and this habit of cycling is a big part of what gives the city a smaller carbon footprint.
That's correct. It's part of it. Copenhagen wants to be carbon neutral by 2025 and actually free itself of fossil fuels by 2050, but that's a longer-term plan. And part of that is through green mobility. It's by simply changing the buses, you know, from diesel and petrol to electricity and hydrogen, and getting more people on bicycles. So the bicycle network is constantly being expanded to make it more attractive for people and easier for people to get from A to B, not necessarily covering the entire distance from home to workspace, but just part of it. So at least you can get to your local metro, you can safely park your bicycle. You might have another bicycle actor at the other end who will bring you the last kilometer and a half in case you work a little bit far away from the metro station at the other end.
And do we have a sense as to whether, in the period of implementation, whether locals were either excited about this or whether they were hesitant about doing so? Because change is always very difficult to implement.
I think overall, everybody bikes in Denmark. So there is that fundamental understanding of the usefulness of expanding the bicycle network in the cities. Of course, you have to hold that up against the necessity for vans and others to be able to reach the shops and stores and so on. But nevertheless, what you see in many cases are that what used to be 4-lane roads are turned into 2-lane roads. So just one lane in each direction, and you expand the bicycle paths. Because there are so many people on the bicycle paths that we have traffic jams now.
Wow.
And you have you have cargo bikes and people, ferrying their kids around in bicycles and so on. So you need to be able to get around those broader, wider cargo bikes. So now we have, bicycle paths as wide as roads.
That's His Excellency Mr. Nikolai Ruji, Danish Ambassador to Malaysia, as well as Dr. Shireen Fariz from UPM. After this, we'll consider the possibility of bringing the cycling culture into our own cities here in Malaysia. Stay tuned. This is 2 Degrees Centigrade on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
You're back on 2 Degrees Centigrade with me, Ezra Zayed. Our focus today has been on Copenhagen, which is well on its way to becoming carbon neutral in less than a decade. The capital is consistently ranked as one of the most livable cities in the world. One of the most notable aspects of Copenhagen, which encourages a healthy, vibrant, and sustainable lifestyle, is the culture of cycling as a popular mode of transport around the city. In Kuala Lumpur, there's been great efforts to encourage people to pick up their bicycles. For example, the independent initiative by the Bicycle Map Project, headed by Jeffrey Lim. And this is in collaboration with DBKL to construct cycling routes around the city. Besides that, there are public parks with bicycle rentals, and Putrajaya remains a favorite among cyclists. But we certainly have a long way to go.
When I was in cycling from my home to my university, I was actually smiling because I'm actually happy. I say, oh, this is why the Danes were voted the most, the happiest nations until recently. Norway took over, but I think for so many years, I was actually smiling.
That's Dr. Shireen Fariz from University Putra, Malaysia, who spent a few years in Copenhagen researching the green urban spaces in the city, as well as their cycling culture. I'm also speaking with His Excellency, Mr. Nikolai Ruji, Danish Ambassador to Malaysia.
And then there's also, you have to learn all those when you go to the right. So there's a few rules that you have to know before you start cycling for your own safety. And then when we talk about, just now you were asking about the network, the bicycle network. In fact, we actually carry out a research, and we have a PhD student conducting a research of how our network is, the cycling network in Malaysia. What we found out from all the photos that she took was that it's quite surprising, because we noticed that when suddenly you have a bicycle lane and suddenly you have a bollard across the road. Mm-hmm. So you have to stop cycling. So what happened after that? And then also it's very narrow for the people to cycle. And also at the same time, we know that people are complaining when we ask question why you do not use this. Of course, it's the weather. And another thing is that the maintenance factor, it was not taken care of, the bicycle lane. So people, that's what we can see when we were driving, especially along Putrajaya, people choose to use the main road because it's for them it's better, it's more flat. Yeah, I think that's one of the problems we see during the initial finding when we talk about the bicycle network in Malaysia.
Could I make just one comment
Absolutely.
About the weather? Because I very often hear that argument that it's too humid here and so on. And fair enough, it is very humid. And you would tend to get sweaty if you go fast for longer distances on a bicycle. But you just have to remember that Copenhagen is pretty far to the north in Europe, and we have a very harsh winter, actually.
That's right.
But the number of bicycles only dropped by about 25%, because people still want to be on the bike. They dress for the snow, and if it's drizzling, which it often is in Copenhagen, they dress for the rain. So it's also a matter of attitude, whether you want to do it or not. Yeah. And of course, it does help that there is that broader infrastructure around using bicycles, that almost any institution in Denmark, being a factory or a university or a college or whatever, they would have facilities so you can change and you can even have a shower if you need me.
Yeah. And that's something I wanted to touch on. Whether in implementing something like this in a city like Copenhagen, did it require a buy-in from different stakeholders, whether it be the private sector or the public sector, whether to ensure that this was going to be something that was going to be implemented successfully rather than something that would only last a small period of time, and for it to be expanded to other parts of Copenhagen as well?
There were different municipalities that had to work together because they've introduced 28 super bicycle lanes, which are even wider and are positioned so that you avoid the most difficult traffic obstacles, and there are small bridges put in over the major roads and so on. And that can bring you all the way from the suburbs, which would be a different municipality, into Copenhagen. So there's been that kind of collaboration between the different municipalities. But again, I think the basic driver is the desire for Danes to be able to use their bicycles. So there's this constant demand. And actually, the Copenhagen has been putting in now also new bridges, which are exclusively for pedestrians and bicycles. And you know, they love them. I mean, the numbers that have been using one of the latest new bridges that have been put in has just, you know, overshadowed the expectations by quite a distance.
Mm. And when we talk about, I guess, you know, apart from reducing the carbon footprint, are there other economic factors, other different elements that would encourage other cities to follow suit and say, hey, you know, it's not just about reducing the carbon footprint, there are other benefits as well?
There's been a big study done on the health benefits of bicycling, and they are quite tangible. I mean, apparently they amount to, what was it, like 50 cents per kilometer or so.
Yeah.
I did a calculation, how many thousand ringgits, you know, in principle I would have I would have earned just by going back and forth the 70 kilometers I did from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to my home every day when I lived in Copenhagen. So there's a health benefit to it as well.
Mm. Dr. Shireen, I mean, if we were to move the needle along to ensure that something like this could be implemented in some type of scale, as you mentioned, you know, to put some pilot projects across the Greater Klang Valley area to begin with. Some states have introduced to encourage cycling on weekends, so cars are not allowed to be, in certain parts of Penang, for example. Mm-hmm. Are you encouraged by what you're seeing, or do you see some real challenges and obstacles?
Well, after I came back, I can see that there are steps being taken, like people are showing to fold their bikes and put it, go on the LRT with the ministers and all that. I think this is very good to encourage people. And then you can see in Putrajaya, people are cycling at night. And then once a month, they have with their family. I think this is a good step to encourage. But the way I look at it, in order for us to really push for, because what we find out also from our study was that the term network, when we start to use it, green network, what does it mean? Does it really mean a continuous cycling lane? Is it being well maintained? Is it the facilities and all that? So the definition has to be right. So when we want to use the word cycling network, we have to go all out. For me, it can be done. I've seen it done. And we have to get a lot of support from the municipalities and all that. And also, I found out that by having all this in between the lane, we have green spaces, like pocket spaces. So this will encourage people to use it more because you know that we don't want Malaysian. We get as close as possible to a park or to a place. So when we have this pocket spaces, places of green spaces, we can connect all these areas and we can make it work to encourage people to use bicycle to go to these gardens or parks.
I wanted to touch on the issue of waste management, and Dr. Shireen, you mentioned about, I guess, observing the Copenhageners and their recycling habits.
Yeah.
To what extent were your observations? I mean, because that, you know, going to the supermarket and bringing in your own bags, that's something that a lot of folks in the Klang Valley currently do. They think about that now on the weekends. What other things did you observe?
All right. Another thing that I observe is that when I was sitting down with my colleague in Denmark, they clean their plates. So, I'm sorry, but I think Malaysian, we are really, food is the center of our life. So everything, we have functions, we have festival, we have canuries, we have a lot of...
That's right.
You know, so we tend to waste a lot of food. I think this is what Nicolas has been talking about, food wastage and all that. And I found out that this is actually, I mean, not all people are doing that, but majority when I observe during when we have events and all that, we really waste a lot of food. And I think that's we should have just take what we need. And I think this all goes back to the attitude. I'm really glad that I'm given this opportunity to talk because I've been observing this for so long, and I hope that we will have less food wastage because of our culture and all the food. But yeah, I think that's what I really want to say.
Ambassador, when it comes to, waste management, are there things that are being implemented and enforced in Copenhagen that have, you know, over the course of time shown some positive signs?
Yeah, I think in terms of waste management, I think it's important to note that it's only 1% of Copenhagen's waste that ends up in landfills, and most of that is hazardous waste. So it really has to go to a proper sanitary landfill. The rest is either being recycled, reused, or incinerated. We incinerate a lot of waste for heating. We have district heating, which is a very efficient way of heating a large area. Actually, it's almost all of Copenhagen, which is now covered by district heating. And a lot of that comes from incineration of waste, in addition to both some fossil fuels, but also renewable fuels.
I gather that in its entirety reduces the cost to the city by quite a bit then.
It does, yes. And also, you know, by reusing and recycling, it increases the lifespan of the materials that have gone into the production.
And when it comes to sustainable energy production methods, what specific methods have been adopted in Copenhagen?
Copenhagen uses wind power. Among the renewable energies, it's particularly wind power, but it's also biomass, some geothermal, and some solar power as well. Wind power is big. Unfortunately, there is actually no real possibility for that in Malaysia. Malaysia is in the doldrums, as it's called, and there's not a big potential yet. Technology may develop, it may change, but at the moment there is not a big potential. But there is in Denmark. So, for instance, Copenhagen recently put up 3 2-megawatt wind turbines, and they can collectively provide all the electricity needed for 3,000 households.
That's quite significant, isn't it?
It's quite significant. But that's because windmills are getting bigger and bigger, and we have an industry of producing windmills in Denmark as well, and we test some of the largest windmills in the world. In fact, when you fly into the airport of Copenhagen, you literally fly over these offshore windmills because they're increasingly offshore. We don't put them onshore anymore. We put them offshore because the wind is more stable and you're not bothering any neighbors out there. The fish don't complain.
Yes. That's His Excellency Mr. Nikolai Ruge, Danish Ambassador to Malaysia, as well as Dr. Shireen Faris from UPM. After the news, we'll be discussing Copenhagen's urban planning philosophy. Stay tuned to 2 degrees centigrade on the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to 2 Degrees Centigrade with me, Ezra Zayed. Today, I've been speaking with His Excellency, Mr. Nikolai Ruge, Danish Ambassador to Malaysia, as well as Dr. Shireen Faris, Senior Lecturer in the Faculty of Design and Architecture at UPM. Now, we're going to discuss Copenhagen's urban planning strategies and how they drive the city's vibrant lifestyle and sustainability. When it comes to urban planning in Copenhagen, sustainability, it seems that it's not an afterthought. It's very much at the center of all the planning that is done. Dr. Shireen, what do you think are your observations about Copenhagen's urban planning philosophy?
All right. The way I look at it is that they use a mix, we call it mixed building use. Yeah. So meaning that when you build an area for housing, for instance, you have other facilities, you have shops, you have schools, and you have a lot of other amenities, meaning that after hours, the place will be alive. So the way I look at it, it really works. And then I think a lot of places in Malaysia, we have a lot of complaints about crimes because we tend to have an area, okay, this is housing, this is for shops, this is for school, this is not what I observe in Copenhagen. So when they build, they plan an area, they will have a mixed use. So the area will have a vibrant urban environment.
Urban planning is such an interesting area simply because, for the most part, you're dealing with a lot of legacy issues and you're dealing with trying to manage the existing conditions in which your city is in. Were there specific strategies that were thought of when thinking about urban planning in Copenhagen?
There's one philosophy that has influenced the urban planning in Copenhagen a lot, and that really evolves around the thinking of one particular professor of urban planning, which was very much looking at what does it mean to be, you know, a citizen on a day-to-day basis. Because you can design fantastic buildings, and when you see them from above on a model, you know, it all looks nice. But, yeah. You know, how does it feel to be 1.60 meters tall and be at the bottom, you know? And he was both an architect, but he was also studying sociology and, you know, looking at it from a human perspective. So that element of trying to make it a city where it's nice to be a human being is really at the core of the planning exercise. And Copenhagen Municipality, they're quite aware of the need to also mobilize the energies and the creativity of the citizens, not trying to plan everything top down. It's in their strategies that they realize that we have to let something go and give some initiative to local communities and see how it goes. And maybe it's not the way we would have thought if we had designed it at the town hall. But, you know, if that's what they want, that's what they do.
There has to be, I guess, some wiggle room to allow for any form of innovation that might occur, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, and that might come from the people themselves.
Yes. And of course, I mean, it does have to be within, you know, regulations in terms of safety and whatever else. But even within that, there is a lot of wriggle room for local communities and little townships and so on to try and do things their own way. I would also just mention that one big transformation, of course, that Copenhagen has gone through is that it used to be a traditional industrial city with shipyards and polluting factories and so on. And they were all on the waterfront because that was the harbor. So there's been a big transformation of the harborfront over the past 10, 15 years in Copenhagen.
We spoke earlier about some of the economic advantages of making a city green. I imagine that inadvertently it would have created a lot more job opportunities by default as well. Did that take place?
Yes. Copenhagen Municipality have done a number of calculations on this, and it has clearly been a good business case to also go green. It has not been to the detriment of business in Copenhagen, because if you make a city more green, you make it more livable, you make it more efficient. You know, it's a place where people want to live, and where people want to live, business move in. So, of course, real estate along the waterfront has gone up, but that's another thing. But also the mere fact that you try to make the city attractive is a good business proposition.
Now, Shireen, I mean, you know, talking about how it creates more job opportunities, there are all sorts of different possibilities that maybe municipalities and cities are not quite considering, especially here in KLMPJ. Are there some specific opportunities that we're not considering as much as we should?
All right. What I found out about, especially the new buildings, when I observed from the design, is that how great design can help build communities. So what I observe is that the role of the architects, they design it in such a way that we can help to build a community who can integrate with each other. You know, sometimes it takes a bit of a knowledge, a bit of work to think of a great design. I can share with you one example of when I took 2 weeks ago, we were in Copenhagen. We visited the 8 House, the famous 8 House by Jean Ingels.
So if you're yet to be familiar with the 8 House that Dr. Shireen just mentioned, it's a large building in Copenhagen that takes the shape of a bow tie. The 8 House consists of not only residential housing, but also retail premises and offices.
And the student, the architecture student was saying, well, I think it's not a very nice finishing. It looks cheap. It looks the pipes were exposed and all that. But I told him, because what we have to see is that the 8 House was targeted for first-time buyers, and they try to bring down the cost so that the buildings is affordable, which I think Malaysia should think about this. You know, we're not producing architects who build buildings, expensive apartments that we could not afford. So what they did in Copenhagen, like the VM House, the 8 House I mentioned just now, is the design was fantastic. We were like, I think the construction is going to give a headache, but the design was fantastic and we won awards. And it was affordable. And it was using prefab concrete and modular materials like wood, aluminium, and you have glass. So I think this is what fantastic when you look at the objective or the focus of when you build buildings for the people.
And Ambassador, what other efforts is the city looking at to truly reach a zero waste and carbon neutral state?
They're doing quite a lot in terms of changing the energy production from the coal and gas-fired power plants into making them run on biofuels. That's really what actually in percentage-wise is driving the CO2 reduction. While green mobility is about 10%, and consumption, the way that energy is used and how much is being used in the building stock is about another 10%. So those are the big areas, and it's particularly converting the power plants into renewable energy.
And the target is 2025, is that right?
2025. But I should also be honest, of course, and say that it's carbon neutral doesn't mean that there will be no carbon used. It actually means that it will be carbon neutral. So there is also an element of the plan which means offsetting. And Copenhagen is sometimes even a net exporter of green energy.
And right now, if you were to identify one or two, what are some of those challenges in reaching that target of carbon neutral?
Yeah, there are challenges because, of course, you start with the low hanging fruits, and it's getting tougher and tougher. But the installation of more offshore wind turbines is going to make one of the biggest difference. And then there are more plans for introducing electric cars. The whole fleet for the municipality itself is by now 70% electric or hydrogen driven, and that will go up to close to 100.
We've just got a couple more questions, and I guess I'd like to ask, seeing that you had, spent a little bit of time in Denmark, do you think there are some things that you'd like to see here in Kuala Lumpur or implemented right across the country? Are there specific things, or rather low-hanging fruit, that could be done?
Well, of course, what comes to my mind now is the cycling, because I think we're getting, like Nikolai said, very choke up.
In our
city center. So I would love to see that we really put an effort to make cycling is one of our priority instead of using cars to get from one place to another. And by trying to achieve that, I hope that we really change our attitude, especially our attitude, I think, and also in terms of the planners, the architect, the landscape architects. We really have to put a lot of effort and work closely with the municipalities and how we can make the cycling lane or the green network really work to get from one place to another without any hindrance.
Copenhagen has modernized its public city bicycle fleet. So it's now they're electric. And they got touchpad screens and GPS, and it'll tell you, you can ask it where you would like to go, and it'll give you directions and so on, and you can book it and lock it and unlock it via an app and so on. So that's just an example of something which means that the individual doesn't necessarily have to have his or her own bicycle, but you can actually go to the city center and then use that network of publicly available bicycles.
Mm. Ambassador, last question is for you. I guess you've lived here in Kuala Lumpur in the busy hustle and bustle of the city centre. And are there certain things that you'd like to see here in Kuala Lumpur that could possibly be implemented?
I think it would be possible to make the city of KL a little bit more, and I know DPKL is working on it, trying to make it a little bit more pedestrian-friendly in addition to bicycle-friendly. I get a sense that quite often the solution to a traffic congestion problem here is widening the roads, another flyover.
Yes.
And I think all international experience just shows that it doesn't solve the problem. You just, the traffic goes up and the same problem would occur somewhere else. And in the meantime, you're just expanding the area in the city that you covered with tarmac. And it doesn't make a charming city. So I think trying to change that trend, I think, would be important to maintain KL as a livable city and make it even more livable in the future.
That was His Excellency Mr. Nikolai Ruji, Danish Ambassador to Malaysia, as well as Dr. Shireen Fares from the Faculty of Design and Architecture at UPM. This episode of 2 Degrees Centigrade was produced by Josie Liu. If you missed any part of this interview, you can download the podcast in our app, and that's available on Google Play or the Apple App Store. I'm Ezra Zayed on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.